Listening Library presents Alice and Freda Forever, A Murder in Memphis, by Alexis Coe. Read for you by Sophie Amos, with an introduction from the author.
For Alice Mitchell, 1872 to 1898, and Freda Ward, 1874 to 1892. Main characters. Alice Mitchell, nicknames, Allie, Alvin J. Ward, A.J.W., Freda Myra Ward. Frederica Ward, nicknames, Freda, Fred, Freddy, Patty Singh, Pitty Singh, Singh. Alice Mitchell's family, George Mitchell, father, Isabella Mitchell, mother, Robert Mitchell, older brother, Frank Mitchell, older brother, Maddie Mitchell, eldest sister, Addie Mitchell, older sister. Freda Ward's family, Thomas Ward, father, Ada Volkmar, eldest sister, surrogate mother, Joe Ward, older sister, William Volkmar, brother-in-law, Ada's husband. Judge, defense, and prosecution. Julius DeBose, judge. Colonel George Gant, defense. General Luke Wright, defense. Malcolm Rice Patterson, defense. George Peters, prosecution. Miscellaneous. Lily Johnson, Alice's best friend. Nickname, Jessie Rita James. Ashley Roselle, suitor, romantic rival. Lucy Franklin, Mitchell family cook. Introduction. When I first learned about the 1892 murder of 17-year-old Freda Ward by her ex-fiancé, 19-year-old Alice Mitchell, I was riding a New York City subway on my long commute home from graduate school. I remember it well because I was so engrossed in the act of imagining their lives, I missed my stop, and then three more. I'd been reading a scholarly article about the case, but I kept losing Alice and Freda in the academic talk of identity politics and American modernity, and so I'd closed my eyes and tried to hear their voices through the dense text to visualize their story. But I had little more than a train ride for such reveries. I was already a year into research on citizenship, and I was determined to be the kind of historian who focused on law, not love. Nevertheless, I slowly started collecting newspaper articles about the Mitchell Ward case, struck by their sensational headlines and front page placement, and intrigued by the physical evidence they mentioned. Love letters, a bottle of poison, a father's razor. After I graduated, I worked as a research curator in the exhibitions department at the New York Public Library. With my personal collection of Alice and Freda materials growing and my experience in public engagement deepening, I began to picture different ways of sharing their story. I longed to tell it on the page as a nonfiction narrative, not a study, accompanied by the kind of stirring visuals an exhibition case offered. I imagined a book that was both written and curated. I wanted readers to see my research, to explore the archival mix, connect with the material, and draw their own conclusions. 6 years after I missed my subway stop, I found myself walking through Elmwood Cemetery, led by Vincent Astor, a local historian in Memphis, Tennessee. I was, at this point, thoroughly consumed by the sad tale of Alice and Freda. The closer we got to their graves, the heavier my body felt. I reminded myself, as I always do when approaching that very last folder in an archive, you already know how the story ends. But the truth is, you never really know. Just then, as I was gingerly sidestepping graves, Vincent paused for a moment and turned to me. "If you're remembering their names and telling their stories," he said in a gliding, southern drawl, "they won't mind if you're stepping on their toes." In this book, I hope to have done just that. Alice and Freda's names, once well known across America, are now recognized by only a small group of people, and yet their tragic story will feel familiar. They were teenagers in love, and they planned to spend the rest of their lives together. Their relationship, plagued by issues of jealousy and infidelity from the very beginning, was fraught in no small part because it was illicit. In 1892 Memphis, few people had heard of same-sex love, and even fewer believed it was anything less than perverse. And from the moment the romantic nature of Alice and Freda's relationship was discovered, that was all they heard. It was wrong. It was unnatural. It was impossible. It was forbidden. There's a good deal of fault to be found in both Alice and Freda. Most clearly, of course, in Alice's unconscionable act of violence. But two women loving each other and wanting to make a home and a life together is not one of them. And yet, when Freda was 6 feet underground and Alice behind bars, it was Alice's motivation, love, and not the bloody murder, that was said to be insane. Alice was driven mad by a perverse passion, medical experts would testify. Their observations were recycled time and time again. More than 120 years later, today's listeners will find much of that world is sadly familiar to us. While I offer historical context, this is very much about Alice and Freda's short-lived romance. To tell that story, with so few primary sources and even fewer trustworthy ones among them, I have strained to hear their voices in the archives, newspapers, medical journals, school catalogs, courtroom proceedings, and of course, their love letters. When there was agreement among sources, I made note of it and gave those quotations priority. From the very beginning, I noticed obvious fabrications driven by various agendas, and I wrote that in too, in order to bring the listener closer to historical actors, to hear their voices. I pulled dialogue from courtroom testimony and newspaper articles, illuminating intimate moments and, in darkly funny turns, imagining how the faulty reasoning of some of our historical actors leads to absurd conclusions.
Part 1. Girl Slays Girl. Chapter 1. I don't care if I'm hung. For days on end, heavy snow descended on Memphis. The roads were slick with ice, and the wind was chilling. But for Alice Mitchell, home was no refuge. It had become her prison. Every morning, 19-year-old Alice arose from yet another sleepless night to find a landscape unaltered, a city blanketed in white. Through the frosted windowpane, she watched her father and brothers come and go as they pleased. No one questioned their trips downtown or suggested their business could wait until the weather improved. But the Mitchell women were governed by a different set of rules. And what would Alice say on her own behalf? The truth was not an option, and she could conjure no lie convincing enough to justify exposing herself to the tempest outside. So she waited, enduring one anxious, blustery day after another, until finally, darkness descended, and the house fell quiet. If it continued this way, she would miss Freda Ward altogether. But Alice refused to let that happen. She had made a solemn declaration, and she intended to make good on it. In the meantime, she could find no solace in her house, no distraction through sewing or reading. Alice had no interest in food, in eating it or making it, and yet she spent most of her waking hours in the kitchen, where she had hidden the locked box. She would spend hours studying its treasures, the love letters, the photograph, the engagement ring. It was an archive of heartbreak. It was all she had left. Alice had shown the ring to Lucy Franklin, the Mitchell family's African-American cook, and shared her tale of star-crossed love, how her hopes for the future had been so cruelly dashed by disapproving relations. Even though Lucy was a captive audience, she felt genuine concern for young Alice and tried as best she could to console her. This went on for months, but Alice withheld parts of the story from Lucy, allowing assumptions to stand in the place of truth. Over time, Alice's inconsistent narrative grew confusing, but as Lucy would later testify, it hardly mattered. As far as she was concerned, the story became secondary to Alice's manner, unsettling to the point of distraction. But there was no one Alice could truly confide in.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?